We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Brought to you in part by International Wildlife Crime Stoppers, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and Maine Operation Game Thief. Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 104, part 2 of Chris Johnson, Alaska State Trooper. And we had to do a part 2 because Chris just had some dynamic stories, and I think he ended the podcast with me last time by telling me, boy, we'd even talk about the time my truck went through the ice. And I was like, oh boy, that's definitely a story for Warden's Watch. So Chris, let's do this again. And he not only gave us that story, but a few others that are really, really cool. So I enjoyed my trip to Alaska listening to Chris, and I think you'll continue to enjoy your trip to Alaska as well, to understand a little bit of Alaska. And Chris goes into the Alaskan State Troopers and his transition there and what makes him very unique, which is pretty incredible. So also, they're offering a $20,000 sign-on bonus currently. So if you ever thought that you might want to make that move to Alaska, now might be the time. I want to continue with reading some of my my ratings and reviews here on Apple Podcasts. It's been great, and I appreciate everybody that has done a recent updated review. I appreciate that, and we'll be getting to those eventually. But since I have never done this before, I've got a little backlog here, so we're going to go through a few more here. So the title of this is Warden's Watch, Jacob T99. And Jacob says, amazing content for game wardens, aspiring game wardens, and those interested in the outdoors. Wayne does a great job of being diverse in his interviews, bringing not only game wardens, but other individuals related to the outdoor industry. I enjoy the podcast, and I hope it continues on. Thanks, Jacob. The next one titled, great. Fantastic job at showing the world what game wardens do on a day-to-day basis. Thank you. The next one is from Austin, and I won't say a last name just in case you don't want it, but I'm listening to this podcast all the time and always makes me happy knowing that you were trying to bring people back to being a game warden, and I really agree with you that there's not enough game wardens in the country. Thank you. Well, thank you, Austin. I appreciate that. This one, I love the title of this, Must Listen! This podcast is amazing for game wardens or those interested in the career field. Hearing the stories and the viewpoints from other game wardens is very beneficial and entertaining. Absolute must listen! Exclamation point. And to go follow their social media accounts and check out the store as well. So thank you very much for that review. Again, awesome podcast! Exclamation point. Great interview with the game wardens from all over the country. Feels like you're sitting in someone's kitchen table with a cup of coffee, listening to friends talk about their most interesting jobs. Especially love New England-based episodes. Humbly request more Maine warden interviews. And we've done a few more, I think, since that was posted. So, and that's from the Murdoch girl. So, thank you very much. Great podcast. Wayne and his guests provide an entertaining behind-the-scenes look at the world of wildlife law enforcement and the great outdoors. Listening to this podcast not only entertained my family and I, but has also provided lots of educational content. It has not only piqued my interest in working outdoors, but my son's as well. We look forward to each new episode. Thanks for the great content and excellent work. Super. I really appreciate that one. This is educational and exciting. I look forward to this podcast. Highly recommend, especially for current, future game wardens, or anyone who enjoys the natural resources. I only wish new episodes would come out more frequently. Thank you very much. 10 out of 10. So, that's great. I put out as muddy as I can, and sometimes I struggle to get out 2 a month just because of my schedule and everything else I've got going on. But I certainly appreciate that, and we will see in the future how we can engage. Speaking of engaging, this one says engaging. A great podcast for anyone who enjoys the outdoors. Good interviews and stories with past and present game wardens and people who are involved in with any aspect of conservation and the outdoor lifestyle, and all that encompasses. Nice to hear from different perspectives from all genres and both men and women in the field. So I kind of butchered reading that one, but and then this is an excellent podcast. These podcasts are outstanding. I look forward to listening to this every time it comes out. Wayne's an excellent presenter and has some great guests. Super. I'm going to leave it at that, and I will continue on reading those, and I really appreciate those guys and girls that are adding to them as we go. So there's been some new posts on Apple Podcasts, and greatly appreciate it. It's the algorithms that change things around. So if, just like on social media, if you like somebody's page, if you make a comment or something, it feeds into that. So it helps you reach people. I could go into that. I've learned a lot since this podcast has been around, and just the social media aspect of it. So thanks a lot, and enjoy Chris Johnson's interview, Alaska State Trooper, Brown Shirts, as they're called. So on this episode of Warden's Watch, this is a part 2 with Chris Johnson. There's just so much you can talk about and so time you can spend, and the stories just keep coming. And as soon as we stopped recording last time, Chris was like, geez, I didn't even talk about the time my truck went through the ice. It was your truck, right?
Well, it was my truck and the suspect's truck.
Oh, boy. So this is a good one to get into. But I want to do a little clarifying on the first podcast. I was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife seasonal refuge officer, and that term has changed, hasn't it, Chris?
Yes, it has. They now call them federal wildlife officers.
Which makes so much sense. I like for marketing, branding, you know, it's just clear, to the point. And I'm sure you spend a lot less time explaining what you are.
Yeah, what I was, I guess.
What you were. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
No problem. Sometimes I forget.
Yeah. It's got to be hard to change hats and doing a very similar job.
It's been just really smooth transition for me. I'm just loving it.
Very cool.
I'm in the field every day now. And before I was a captain, and I was in the field quite a bit for a captain, but now my job is back out in the field again. So
Wow.
Really enjoying my time with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers.
Awesome. No, that's really good. You can represent both sides. There's not too many people. You're probably the only one that can represent both sides for sure. So, you know, you caught my attention when you said the truck through the ice. Yeah, we've had trucks through the ice. It's never been, I can't think of whoever been one of them. I'm sure there's other game wardens that have put their trucks through the ice, but I don't even want to think about that because the paperwork just in my mind, I'm like, oh no, I hate to do that call to the colonel and tell him, yeah, colonel, I just put my cruiser through the ice.
I kind of got lucky, but I'll explain.
Yeah, go for it.
This was on Hidden Lake. It's a real pretty popular lake trout fishing lake on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. And there's several guys out there. It's kind of a game. In Alaska, you can't use live bait for fishing. The big reason for that is they don't want to introduce non-native fish to lakes that don't have those particular fish. So it's illegal to use live bait. So it's kind of a game with some of the guys out there. They use live bait because it's more effective, and they try getting away with it, and I try catching them. Really, and the resource, they catch live bait. They'll put minnow traps out on the lake that they're actually fishing and catch them there. So it's not, they're not introducing new fish, but it's still against the law.
Correct.
And it's kind of a game that they'll sit out there with spotting scopes and try and watch the access points. So I try and find different ways to sneak on the lake and whatever. So one particular day, I parked on top of the hill before you got to the lake, and then I climbed up a mountain, a small mountain, and got a spotting scope out, and I could see that there's these guys that they're typically trying to use live bait. I've caught them before using live bait. So I sat and watched them, did some surveillance for a while, and I watched this. This was late March, early April. So the days are getting long, and the ice is starting to get thinner. But still, there was a good 2 feet of ice most of the lake. So I was watching these guys. I watched them take off right about just before dark. I watched them take off in their truck to the other end of the lake. So I started on foot trying to follow where they went. And as I'm walking along the shoreline, I spotted a tip-up. A tip-up is it's got a flag on it. When the fish bites the line, the flag comes up and hooks the fish. And, you know, the fishermen can see it from a distance. So I come along this tip up. So I walk up the tip up. I pull it up. Up there's live bait on it. So I put it. And then about that time, I see some headlights heading back down the lake towards me. So I put the tip up back in, and I run to the shoreline, and I hide in the woods. And here comes a truck. He pulls up, stops at the tip up, pulls it up. I run out. Dave, game warden, you're busted. He said, no, it's not mine. It's the other guy. He said, nah. So I'm talking to him for a few minutes, and then we see headlights coming back down towards us. So I said, get out of here. I already know his name and everything. So I go back and hide in the woods, and now it's pitch dark. And this other truck stops right at the flag, and he runs out, and he starts pulling it up. And I run out. Hey, game warden, Dave, you're busted. This guy's name was also Dave, and I knew him. You're busted. So we ended up, he said, no, it's the other guy's. No. So I ended up writing both of them tickets for using live bait. And then I hiked out, and then I pretended to leave. I climbed back up on my little mountaintop there with the spotting scope. And, you know, about a half hour later, here goes the truck back across the ice with its headlights on. So I said, you know what? I'm going to follow them with lights out across the lake. So I jump in my cruiser and I head across the lake. And I know this lake really well. At night, with no lights, you kind of lose depth perception. There's this one area where it's about 75 yards off of shore. There's a big boulder that kind of just barely hits the tip of the ice. In the springtime, that boulder gathers a lot of heat. So the ice around that starts to melt. Well, I lost my depth perception, so I didn't realize where I was on the lake. I'm just focusing on these headlights at the opposite end of the lake. And I'm driving along. I got my window down, and I'm driving along, and all of a sudden comes an immediate stop, and I can hear water in my tires, and I'm not moving, and I got my foot on the accelerator. So I look out the window, and I can see there's water on my tires. What had happened is I drove and I high centered my truck on this boulder, and all four tires were splashing water. So I'm out here, I look around. I don't want to get on the radio and tell dispatch that my truck has gone through the ice. So I get on the phone and I barely have cell reception there. And I call my boss, and all he hears is truck through the ice, and then we get cut off again.
Oh,
so he's kind of in a panic. I do reconnect with him, and then he comes down, and he's going to meet me at the boat ramp. So I grab all, I don't know, really, it's dark out. I can open my door, and there's actually ice right by my, I can step out onto the ice. So I grab all my gear and guns and everything I can, because I don't know what's going to happen. Uh-huh. I really haven't had a chance to take a look and see what happened with my truck. I just know I got all four tires going splish, splash, splash when the tires are turning. And I get my light out, and I go, okay, this doesn't look good. So I grab all my gear I can get out, and then I haul it over to the shore and hide it in the woods. And then I got about a mile and a half walk across the ice, carrying my rifle and what my backpack and stuff to go meet, because my supervisor isn't going to drive his truck out on the ice. And about the time right when I get to the boat ramp, here's one of the guys that had already written a ticket, and he's drunker than a skunk. And he comes out and he starts talking to me, and I'm in no mood to talk. I just, Dave, just go away. I'm kind of steaming. And I didn't want to tell him what happened, but so I get him away, and I get a ride back to town with my supervisor. And tomorrow we're going to go evaluate what my truck looks like, because it was still up. So the next day I head out there with one of our maintenance guys, and my truck has a wench on it, and we had another truck that had a wench on it, and there's still good 2 feet of ice most parts of the lake. So we head out there. On the way out there, I get a call from this other Dave. One of the guys, the other guy that wasn't drunk, but the other guy that was up across the lake, and he's kind of sheepish. He goes, I heard you got your truck went through the ice. I said, yeah. And he goes, well, do you mind taking a look at mine? Mine went through the ice too. And I was like, oh, yes. There is a God.
Said that myself.
So I went out, and I was able, with 2x6s, drill a hole, put a dead man chained down through the ice, connect both wenches to each other. And I was able to wench it was nip and tuck, because right around this big boulder, it's 20 feet deep. I mean, you can look down and it's 20 feet deep. There's just this big boulder sitting right there. But it was nip and tuck. I got my truck off the ice. And then I later came back with a snowmobile. His truck went all the way. Just the top of his roof was up on his.
Oh, man.
And then I was able on snowmobile, I was able to find a lot. They had a lot more tip-ups out on the lake. So they were doing their typical thing. They're putting out lots of lines with live bait and So that's to end this story. It doesn't end that. A couple of years later, these same two guys, same time of year, one of them was driving his truck across the same lake, or his van, and he went through the ice and he drowned. I ended up pulling his body out of the lake, but he was one of those same guy. It was the guy that was really drunk at the boat ramp. He ended up pulling his body out of the lake. So that's my truck through the ice story.
So how did you get the other truck out? Do you have like a company that specializes in that type of thing? Or
luckily he's about 25. There was a shoal, sandbar shoal that was gathering heat through with the sun, and it was right next to an island. So we were able to connect. I went out there and helped him.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to connect a couple wenches to some trees, and we were able to pull it out. And then he was able to tow it off the ice, and it was, I think it was a brand new diesel truck. I'm sure it was trashed.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But luckily there are some, there's not any companies that specialize in it, but we've had numerous trucks and cars go through the ice over the years, and we've had a couple people get them recovered once with a helicopter.
And wow. Then,
another time they put the balloons underneath the vehicle, and then they fill the balloons up and it raises it to the top, and then they turn it to the boat ramp in the summertime. But
So I've seen them cut slots too, if they're close to shore, cut slots with a skidder and hook a skidder to it. And that actually folded the truck in half.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't a great Chevy commercial. So, but no, anything through the ice. I mean, geez, in my career, I've had a groomer through the ice, which it was pretty ingenious how they did it. They actually, you know, built a frame that slid over the hole, and then divers went down, attached it. They raised it up into the frame, and then they used a skidder to slide it out of the area, which was pretty unique. And that spot was just a spring hole. Just developed on a small pond that they'd been running groomers across for years and years and years, and it was the dead of winter too. It was cold, so it wasn't like it was a thaw. It was just that spring hole hadn't allowed ice to gather enough. So, and usually those groomers, you know, they're pretty wide, so they disperse a lot of their weight too. So that was kind of a shocker to have that, but that certainly changed a lot of the way people did business and avoiding lakes, and you didn't have trails going across lakes and ponds as much anymore. The groomer would stop there and find another route around. Snowmobiles would continue on, but certainly during my tenure, and I'm sure nationwide, we've had quite a few vehicles through the ice. What I think of is that I was a trainee, so we have aquifers, and then you guys probably do around docks and stuff. So bubblers basically to keep them open. And I was a trainee then, and I was chasing a guy on an ATV. And I lost his taillights, and I thought he'd got up on the island. And I stepped on it, you know, even faster. He was on a four-wheeler. I was on a snowmobile. And thank goodness there was a game warden ahead of me and started waving like crazy. And I put the old binders on. That four-wheeler was in the water upside down because the tires were the only thing floating on that four-wheeler. And the guy was in the water, and he'd hit one of those aquifers on his way. So, and I was going to be shortly behind him if there wasn't a warden ahead of me to wave me off. Yeah, that was gnarly. I think back to that, and that would have been maybe the end of my my career.
I think of another time. We have this big lake. It's called Skelak Lake. The Kenai River runs into it. It's a big glacier-fed lake, and it's, I think it's 12 miles long, and it's over 1,200 feet deep. Well, one night at the boat ramp, I saw headlights going across the lake a couple miles out, and they were stopping. And then they'd go on, and they'd stop again. So I thought, someone's putting a bunch of lines out. So I got the great idea. I'd go out there, lights off, and follow them in their tracks. And so I did, and I got out to this island. There's an island where there's some people live out on, and I got out there, and I ended up talking to the guy, and he was just drilling holes in the lake to check ice depth while he was driving. And he said, the first thing out of his mouth is, did you see that open water we drove right past? And of course, I'm driving with lights out. And I said, no. And now I have to drive back. That's the last time I drove a truck on Skelak Lake. I only take snowmobiles on there now or boats.
Yeah. Understandable. and I love to tell the story where my old colonel, Marty Garabedian, and the police chief actually took a physical cruiser across the ice because they couldn't make it up the hill. So they got onto the ice and off to the boat ramp where they got But that was just the old cruisers. I don't think it was a truck, four-wheel drive or a Tahoe or anything, but they couldn't make it up the hill that they needed that went down to the lake, so they decided to take the lake, if I'm remembering that story closely. But I always cracked me up that they took the lake and drove the cruiser down the lake, because I would have gotten really a lot of trouble for doing that. You know, one thing I wanted to talk to you, Chris, to get off the subject a little, because we got some really cool stuff to talk about, but physical fitness, because a lot of people that are inspiring game wardens listen to the Wardens Watch podcast, and physical fitness has become front and center for all law enforcement. And I think you are a great guy to speak of that, A, for, you know, longevity and your career and to stay in shape. I mean, you don't certainly look your age. You're 58, correct?
Yeah, I have to think about it. Yeah, I am 58.
Yeah, I did the math for you, but because the feds made you retire at 57. You've been with Alaska
Yes.
for about a year, so I guessed at that. But you certainly don't look 58, and for what you went through just to take the part time academy with the Alaska State Troopers, you know, was a physical fitness challenge for most people at that age. So, you're inspiring to me, and I think you'd be inspiring to all officers across the nation and the world in how to stay physically fit through your lifetime, and especially when you're coming to get this job, what to do and how to do it and how to maintain that for a career. So, if you don't mind speaking to that, I think that would be beneficial to a lot of our listeners.
Sure. Yeah, physical fitness has always been a part of my life. Since I've been growing up, I was one of those workout warriors. I wanted to play professional football or be a game warden. I think I chose the right career.
I think you did.
I didn't
too.
Have the talent to be a professional football player, but so I've always been a workout warrior. I used to lift a lot of weights. Over the last few years, that's changed. I do more HIIT type workouts. Matter of fact, just yesterday I had my PT test to get back on the CERT team for Alaska State Troopers. Interestingly enough, I'd been on the CERT team for 23 years. And when I got hired on by the troopers, I had to wait a year to get off probation to get back on the team that I'd been on for 23 years. but anyways, I did my PT test yesterday and passed all that fit for duty on that. So
you'll be back on it.
I'll be back on it. And I got to qualify later on today. To finish my entrance back onto the team. But I've changed my workouts over the years. My wife and I own a fitness boutique called Tide Yoga Studio, and it's more than just yoga, a lot of fitness classes and that. And I do teach some classes. I do teach some HIIT classes, high intensity interval training. I do it both on the floor, and then I have a little bit lower impact workout that on little trampolines. You can get the heart rate up, but doesn't have that hard impact, like jumping on a floor. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun, too, just to bounce around on these little trampolines. But I've changed my workouts over the years. Like I said, I used to be heavily in the weightlifting, and it's changed more to more body weight and some lifting. But it's for our job. You got to be able to be physical fit. You got to be able to track, go on long tracks, hike into places. The other day, I was out by myself on a snowmobile, and I got my snowmobile stuck. And trying to pick up these snowmobiles we have nowadays, they're 500, 600, they're 600, 700 pounds.
Yeah. And
then you put your gear on it, and then you're in snow up to your waist. You got to be physically fit to do some of these things, and you just got to make it a part of your life. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they realized that, so they were actually giving an hour a day to work out. Which is that was tremendous.
Do you think a lot of people were taking advantage of that? Because
not a lot were taking advantage.
That's been my experience too. So it sounds like a great benefit, but if you don't use it, then it's not a benefit.
And you have to do, most agencies have to do some kind of wellness testing every year.
Yeah.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we had to participate. We didn't have to. Pass. We didn't have to make any standards. We just had to participate. But I always took it as myself. I always wanted to gauge how I was, my physical fitness. So always tried my best. And so over the years, I could see where I progressed and how things changed over the years, or how I decreased. It seems like I lost about a minute on my mile and a half run every decade or so. The rest of it kind of stayed, plateaued, but so it's a real important nutrition. It's an important part, eating right, getting good exercise. It doesn't have to be hard exercise every day, but you just need to get move the body. My wife is a personal trainer, so I got a little help there. She kind of guides me on some things. But it's a lifestyle, just like being a game warden. It's a lifestyle.
Right. No, for sure. And they got to, for new recruits, they certainly got to get that in their head. And to pass the entrance exams, they have to get into physical fitness. So
yeah,
to get there and to maintain it. I always I've never been a runner, and it seems like running is a lot. I was a sprinter. I'm pretty fast on the front end, but the long term, I was a wrestler in high school.
Just my body wasn't made for running, and I just never really enjoyed it. So that mile and a half, I dreaded it all the time. Now, not that I wasn't, you know, not in shape, but it wasn't my cup of tea and the standards to have that too. So, you know, I'm on the elliptical. I'd rather be on an elliptical. And then I just started rowing again, trying to do that in my 50s to see that low impact, because I have seen the impact of being a game warden on my body. I just got my back. I've got an issue with my back that I have to visit the hospital usually once a year, and they have to, minimum.
Back problems, yeah, your core.
Yeah, it's just, and it was a stupid thing that I did, not thinking. So, snowmobile trailer frozen in. It didn't look frozen in, the front wheel. I kicked it, and then I knew if I put my back into it, it popped right up. Guess what? It didn't pop right up, but my back popped so much that I felt that shooting pain through my body. And, you know, I was like, and then I was like, it's not so bad. I'm like, oh, that's okay. I guess I didn't do anything. But the next day, I couldn't move. And that's been with me ever since. So I will say, even the little stupid things, and you hear about the little stupid things all the time. I mean, and I knew better. It didn't look like the ice had gathered around that tire at all. So I just give it a good swift kick and loosen it up, and I'm going to pop it right out like I had so many times before and pop my back out. And now I'm regretting it to this day, and it will be for the rest of my life, that little indecision of not working smarter and not harder, I guess.
Yeah, I ruptured a quadricep tendon up one time, and that was quite an ordeal. That's a story for another day.
Maintaining your health certainly improves your odds at not getting injured.
Yes.
Going from the feds to the state, are there different standards?
A little bit. Actually, the tests are now very similar.
Okay.
Over the years, they were a little bit different because I was always on the state SWAT team, and they were a little bit different standards, but like 3-4 years ago, they switched them. So they're basically, it's mile and a half run, push-ups to exhaustion. And then with the feds, it was 2 minutes of sit-ups. With the state, it's 1 minute of sit-ups, as many as you can do. So those are very similar.
Right. No. So, but that's certainly a good thing, especially in somebody, I think it was Tom McKinney actually said this the other day, that the physical fitness test is the only test that we give you the answers to, which... I love that, and I'm going to keep using that, so I'm going to continue to use that. And, you know, when I was testing, it was a mile and a half run. I was running 2 miles on the beach. I was exceeding that, so the mile and a half wasn't that hard. And I'm going to encourage everybody that's going in for testing, exceed the expectations. So when the expectations seem pretty dang easy, when you have to meet them, they got to do 30 push-ups, do 40 push-ups on a consistent basis. And I think that is the way to achieve it. You know,
you got to be consistency. You can't be like a weekend warrior and keep your physical fitness up. You just got to be consistent. It doesn't have to be intense every day, but consistency is important.
Right. Yeah.
That'd be my biggest take out of it. Just be consistent with some type of activity, moving your body.
Right.
Getting that heart rate up.
Yeah. And if you're in physical fitness, it helps you when you get captured too, doesn't it?
Yeah. That brings up another story.
I want to hear this story. Chris Johnson getting captured.
Yeah. This was back when I first started. It was back, I think, in 1992. I was a young officer in Alaska. And back at that time, in the springtime, it was not the Migratory Bird Treaty Act didn't allow for taking of migratory birds in the springtime by Alaska natives, or it just wasn't legal. But we realized that is an important part of their lifestyle and culture and their survival is in the springtime, being able to get the birds. That's their fresh meat coming in after a long winter. And when we're talking about the bush, we're talking about, these are off the road system, hundreds, thousands of miles, maybe not thousands, but 1,000 miles off the road system. And they're living a subsistence lifestyle where they hunt and fish for their food.
Right.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service realized that was an important part of their culture and their survival in some of these villages. So we would look the other way at spring, at taking of some of the birds in the springtime, as long as they weren't these bird in dire straits. Like, for example, emperor geese or the black brant used to be in low population. So there was an agreement made with the native associations that we wouldn't enforce the Migratory Bird Treaty Act unless they were taking some of these species that were in danger, like emperor geese and black brant. Mm-hmm. And then they wouldn't use lead shot. So we were out on patrol in this area, and it by airplane. We were flying around Western Alaska in a Super Cub. I was in the back seat, and we spotted, it was April. We spotted some hunters in an area where there were a bunch of emperor geese. So we circled around and landed in the village of Nutuk, which is about a mile or so from where we saw these hunters. And we started walking down the beach to go contact these hunters. And as we landed in the village and then walked down the beach, we had a few people in the village come out and ask what we were doing, and explained the goose management plan, that we were out there enforcing that, and continued walking down the beach. We got within maybe a quarter mile of the guys on the beach that were in the area where there was a bunch of emperor geese, and then they jumped on their snowmobile and then went down about another mile down the beach, and then they sat up on a little hill. So I was with an agent, Mark Webb, Silver Tongue. He had a silver tongue. Anyway, we continued walking down the beach. We contacted these hunters, and about that time, here comes a posse of 17 armed men, and they told us we were going to go back to the village and have a village meeting. And at that time, we had no communications. There was no radio communications. There was no cell phones at that time. So I jumped on the back of the snowmobile with another guy, and Mark continued to talk to most of the group there. And we headed back to the village of Nutuk. And on my way back, an elder of the village met us on the ice pack and said, he stopped us and he told me, "You take off your boots. Take off your boots." It's Chris Johnson, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here. "You're on our land. Take off your boots." And by that time, I'd closed the distance, and he had a shotgun. I quickly wrestled the shotgun away from him, unloaded it. And then about that time, here comes the rest of the posse. I handed the shotgun back to the elder, unloaded, jumped on the back of another snowmobile, and we went back to the village and had a meeting with the village there. And they told us not to come back unless we told them beforehand we were going to patrol the area. Then they let us go. Then we flew out. Interestingly, I had a really nice camera in my backpack that disappeared when I was there. They went through my gear. But that was that week. There's another time, and the same couple, I think the next day, actually, we saw some other hunters in an area. There was a bunch of emperor geese. So we landed and started walking out to them, and they took off across tidal mud in their snowmobiles. I mean, there was no snow. They were taken across on their snowmobiles on tidal mud. One of the snowmobiles got caught, stuck in the tidal mud. The guy just jumped off the back of the snowmobile, grabbed his bag of birds, and ran up to the other guy on the snowmobile and took off and just left his snowmobile there running in the tidal mud. And we were never able to figure out who that, when we went to the village, we were never able to figure out who the snowmobile belonged to. And during that time period, over the shortwave radio or longwave, I don't remember what it's called, over the CBs, we were known as the tall guy and the blonde guy. Back then, I had blonde hair. I think I was 26 years, 25 years old, something like that. And then the guy that was with me was real tall. So all over the Western Alaska, they were on the CBs, they were talking about the tall guy and the blonde guy. And we were able to make, we made a really good case. And this, it's called Chavgon Bay. We caught some guys with 220 black brant, which they weren't supposed to take as part of the goose management plan. So we made a big, nice case on that. Since that time, treaties with Canada, Russia, and Japan, they've allowed for subsistence taking of waterfowl in springtime in Alaska. So it is legal now to hunt some of these birds in the springtime, mm-hmm. which at that time, by treaty, it was not legal, but we'd look the other way unless they were hunting some of these species that were endangered. But that's my story of being
That's captured. That's a pretty good story. And then on the other hand, I mean, you don't want to rock the boat. I mean, you want to make the impression, but you don't want to rock the boat to the point where it hits Washington, D.C., do you?
No. And then they were, yeah, it was on the phone to senators. And that's mm-hmm. not the only time I've been called into the senator's office. Actually, we didn't get called into the senator's office that time, but there's been other times that we've been.
Right.
It is a sensitive issue. And at that, particularly at that time, there's a National Wildlife Refuge out there, Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. And we weren't exactly popular with the refuge out there because enforcement wasn't, because it was causing them problems on other fronts, like weirs and stuff. Some of these rivers out there around these villages.
No, I get it. It's a balance, and it's nice they actually put it on paper so they can do it and doesn't put you in a, you know, it's a tough spot to be in as an enforcement officer when it's illegal, but yet there's these handshake agreements saying that we're, as long as you don't take those species, and then when you do take those species, that, you know, that's still that indigenous people and you understand the rights. So that's a tough thing. And game wardens across the nation experience that when their First Nations, I think Canada calls them, and are the people that were here first.
Yes. And it still is a way of life, a lifestyle out there. And I think it's come a long way. There's been other issues over the years where I've had to go out to Western Alaska and deal with some of these cultural issues, really, and that it's also concerns to them. But it's just king salmon runs out across most of Alaska now are way down. So there's been some restrictions on that, and some of the way they used to harvest their fish, they can't do it anymore. So it's been.
Right.
It's been interesting watching some of the changes and to explain what some of these villages, it is really a subsistence lifestyle out there. They're mm-hmm. living off fish and game.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way they used to do it and are still doing it today. And if you rely on that, it's a way of life for sure.
Yeah. They can't just run down to the grocery store. Most of the villages do have a little store in it, but you're talking about
mm-hmm.
$12 for a gallon of milk.
Yeah. Yep. So you're taking as much salmon and putting that up for the winter as you can. And, and in the spring, you're right. You know, fresh meat is waterfowl, eggs.
Yes.
Until anything greens up. And then you're still gathering stuff to eat on a constant basis.
Yep. It's their lifestyle. That's what they do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I've been to Alaska twice. And one of those trips, I ended up going to a spot where they were dipping salmon. There was some people from the tribe there dipping as well, and just very efficient. And there was only a few of them that were gathering for the whole tribe, but it would seem like every minute they were throwing a salmon into the pot. And, you know, I went over because I wanted to learn how he was doing it, and it was just kind of funny because, you know, he gave me this big song and dance how, you know, he was a Native American and this was really good and had this connection with the salmon. And then as I got to talk with him, he's like, yeah, I'm just busting your chops. There's a little notch in here. They love to stage right here before they start up. So he's like, and, you know, my father taught me this and his father taught me this. So we go right to this little notch every time, and I can catch a salmon every 5 minutes or every minute. But it was interesting to see that way of life and gathering food for the tribe, and then just starting a relationship there. It was kind of cracked me up. So, but he did like the song and dance for a while, and then because I was impressed. I was like, wow. very cool. So one of the other things we were talking about is snaring bears for gallbladders, and that was it's still a thing. Bear gallbladders are certainly on the Asian market. I don't think they're as popular as they were probably 20 years ago, but it is still a thing for sure. And as other things run out, other things become more popular too. So if you can't get your tiger tooth or your, you know, rhino horn, you go back to gallbladder. So.
Yeah, an aphrodisiac. Yeah, it's got a lot of special properties,
mm-hmm.
Which I've learned. This was a really interesting case. It was really a lot of fun to do, and it's pretty interesting. It's one of the biggest gallbladder cases in Alaska. Interestingly enough, one of our biologists was flying around, and he seen a camp near this Indian Creek, which has king salmon running up it. And it's closed the fishing for king salmon in the creek. And he saw a camp there. And there's an, it happened to be, it's on a pipeline that's closed to vehicle traffic during most of the summer, but it opens up during hunting season. And it's pretty, it's four-wheel drive to get way back in there. But there are a couple airstrips along this pipeline where when they're building the pipeline, they built a landing strip so they could fly in supplies. So there happened to be this group camping there, and the biologist mentioned it to me. And I was starting up with a first day of a new trainee. It was his first day. So we decided, I decided we'd go in and do a little bit of surveillance on this. So it was about a 30-mile trip in by four-wheeler, or not four-wheeler, but by four-wheel drive truck. And then I planned to park about 2 miles away, and then we'd hike in the rest of the way and set up surveillance on it. So we drove on in and hiked in, and then as we're circling around the camp, there was a game trail that ran along a ridge above the river. Peeking up there, and there's a snare in the tree right there. I said, okay, I'm just thinking, okay, somebody left one of their snares out during trapping season and just forgot to pick up this snare, which often it does happen when people put out a lot of snares. They forget where all of them are. And snow levels change or whatever. Just looks different. They miss one. So yeah, I didn't think a lot. I just thought, okay, someone forgot a snare here. I know people that trap this area. But as we started circling around the camp, found another snare that was broken, freshly broken, and brown bear hair all over, a little bit of blood. Obviously, after looking at it, a brown bear had gotten part of its leg or something caught in this snare, and it busted it. And then I followed the tracks for a little ways. And then let's get back on target here. So now it's getting me thinking, okay, what are these guys up to? We found a couple snares. This obviously, did someone just leave a bunch of snares out from the trapping season? But as we started to get on the trail, we could see there was fresh human tracks on some of these trails here. And there was fresh, like, grease dumped all around where these snares were and other attractants. So, okay. So now it's starting to click in my head.
What time of year?
This was in June.
Okay.
It's in June. So that started clicking a little bit. Okay, they're putting snares out. They're baiting it. I still hadn't completely thought about, okay, they're getting gallbladders. So kind of circled around, did some surveillance on them, and we saw that they were packing up their gear and getting ready to leave. So we went and contacted them. There were a couple Koreans. They said they didn't speak English. They're getting ready to leave. I asked if I could look in the cooler. I was still looking, you know, still keen in on maybe they are taking king salmon. And looked around. I didn't see really anything unusual there. They did have one jar, that glass jar that had something in it. That was not, I didn't know what it was. I just picked it up, looked at it, said, hey, what's this? And he said something in Korean, and I put it back in his cooler. Didn't know what it was. Didn't know where it came from. Then after they left, I started tracking out of their camp. And found a number of places where there were snares. And you could tell that they'd been there numerous years because there was thread. They used different color threads over the years to help hold up their snares. And then I could see burn marks in the trees where they had actually caught some things over the years. You know, some were older burn marks. And we found one that was, it just happened. We could tell. So, we ran out of days in Alaska in June are almost 24-hour days, and we were starting to get like 11 o'clock at night. So we hiked back out, and then planned to come back the next day and bring a metal detector and do a little bit better investigation of this whole area. I had the names of the guys, so I knew that. So we came back the next day, and we found, I don't know, there was maybe a dozen different snare sets that we found. They'd been pulled. They're gone, but you could find the thread hanging. They'd use the same trees. And I think it was like seven different color threads on there. So we figured, man, 7 years they've been coming back here, snaring bears along this. It's a salmon stream. Bears are going to travel along the salmon stream. Right. There's a good game trail right there. we were able to find where the one new burn mark is. I found a 223 cartridge with the metal detector, and I was continuing searching the area, and I noticed the moss was had been dug up here. Just you hardly could tell, but there was just one corner that was a little black. So I lifted it up, and it was someone cut the moss off. Pick it, and there's a black bear underneath, buried in the moss.
Hmm.
They dug it out, and then it was just an incision along the belly, and the rest of the bear was intact.
Wow.
So their MO was, you know, they'd snare the bear, they'd take the gallbladder out, and then they'd bury it underneath the moss. So you could, I mean, I even walked over this, and I didn't know I was walking on a bear.
Mm.
But I just saw that one. We were getting down on our hands and knees looking for, we knew they killed something there because we found one 223 shell casing there, and we knew they had a 223 with them. So we did our investigation there, photographed and did all our videotaping and searching of all the sites there. Then they used an air taxi to come in. So I did a search warrant on the air taxi and learned different places that they've been flying into over the years. And at that time, I started talking to a Forest Service officer, telling him what was going on an adjacent forest. And he mentioned that they had some people report a remote lake report that they found a bear in a snare. So I flew out to that area, and sure enough, in the logbook, and there's a cabin out there, the same Koreans had stayed at that cabin, and it coincides kind of with the date the bear was caught in the snare. And then went to some of the other locations that the air taxi had dropped them off, and was able to find old track, you know, like trails out in the middle of these. I mean, these are really remote areas where there's not usually trails. Started following these trails, and I was finding these burn marks and threads in the trees where they'd been hanging the snare. So there was several different places we were able to find where they'd actually, I think there's six different burn mark areas where we determined that somebody got a bear or some animal there. We didn't, you know, couldn't tell. Some of them are pretty old. There was no evidence that it was a bear or anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to determine that. Then we did an interview with them. Of course, they didn't speak English, so I had to find an interpreter to.
So they were still in the area.
They're from Anchorage.
Okay.
But I did get some during the search where I found some records where they'd been flying back over to Korea several times a year.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how many bears they'd actually taken the gallbladders, and the main character guy, he was in his almost 80 years old at the time, so. But was able to make a good case on them. The fines and stuff weren't—I don't even remember what they were. They weren't significant. We took in consideration of his age and his health, and but it was just this really an interesting case how it developed and how we were able to find all these different spots where they'd been snaring black bears, targeting black bears. But obviously, they did catch a brown bear in that one because we ended up back going and tracking that to see if the bear. We probably tracked it a good mile and a half through the brush and trees and stuff, but it actually found parts of the snare quite a ways away where it had come off the bear. So it injured that bear significantly, but we didn't find it dead. So, I'm glad we didn't run into it face to face. Injured brown bear would not be a fun thing to deal with.
No, and I'm sure that's why they were targeting black bears. It's a little easier to deal with, I would imagine.
But yeah, I just that investigation, it was really interesting. It was a lot of fun to work, just trying to figure, get in their minds, trying to figure out what they're doing, how they're doing it.
The areas they're doing it in it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what came to my mind, Chris, is when do you spring that investigation? That's one of those what you could have probably waited to the next year, caught them red-handed, or do you do the, you know, and that's, I think that's a balance that we all do in our cases, when to pull the trigger on an investigation. And there's no right reason, no right answer, really. It's really nice to catch them in the act. Certainly it helps with prosecution, but also when you have a map laid out like that, like you did, and then do you have them, you know, participate in that again to harm the resource further? It is a real tough balancing act for a game warden to figure that out. But you want the most solid case that you can have when you bring if it goes to court. So, and those are some of the scales that we weigh.
That was like a perfect opportunity with a new trainee with this investigation. We got to do interviews. We got to do search warrants. we got to go back and do crime scenes, multiple crime scenes that right. over time. And actually, and this, the trainee at the time, he was, he loved to write. And I let him write all the reports. They were so good, much more
detail
than I would do. I'm more like catch them and clean them and let's go on to the next. And,
boy, I bet you've heard that on my podcast before. It sounds like we're cut from the same material.
But yeah, that was just a really, and it made, you know, it was on the news up here in Alaska, and it was a good case. I mean,
it's a great case.
The penalties weren't super, but we ended that type of activity, at least right. with those guys. Haven't seen evidence of that in this area since then, but they're picking remote areas and it and time of the year when people aren't normally in some of these places.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great case. It was really good training and it yeah. was a good case.
I'd call it an epic case. And then just the intensity of when you start fighting that as a game warden, putting it together, yeah. and then finding that black bear. I mean, you got the body.
Yeah, that was and then, you know, during the search warrant, we did find they had scalpels and everything. You know,
wow.
they were.
And during the search warrant, did you recover any gallbladders?
We did not recover any gallbladders.
Yeah, and that's typical too. They dry them out. They ship them fairly quickly. So
yeah. Yeah, and I learned a lot about the gallbladder trade at that time. I don't know what they're going for now, and I don't remember what it was a lot of money
mm-hmm.
back then. I don't even remember how much it was, but I don't know what they go for now.
Right, and I think as all wildlife ebbs and ties, you know, availability of other things, and for sure, and as they become available, if it's hard to get, it becomes more expensive. I think of the Elver trade, our little glass eels on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, those can run up to $5,000 a pound in a good year. But if they're plentiful or they can't get rid of them is the other thing, then the price starts dropping down. But people can make a ton of money on wildlife at different times. So, and gallbladders were one of those.
I think these guys learned their trade in North Carolina because I did little investigations on that, and that's where they'd come from, North Carolina area. And I know that the gallbladder trade in North Carolina at one time was pretty big.
Yeah, it was like the focal point for North America for sure.
So it was a really interesting case, fun to work.
Did they move to Alaska specifically to do that?
I don't know. I don't know. And it was so hard to communicate. Yeah, I had to have an interpreter with that so we could communicate. So you didn't build up a lot of that rapport that you can a lot of times when you're doing interviews.
Right. Yeah.
Just stuff that isn't really matter, that isn't important to your case, but it helps you learn a little bit more what makes them tick.
Yeah, absolutely.
How they're doing it.
Helps you ask the right questions in the right way.
Yes.
And that is so difficult with foreigners for sure. Just growing up in different environments. And you almost have to know their culture to communicate with them on an intelligent level.
Yeah, because you know, they'll look at you, what are you talking about?
Yeah. To me, it's fascinating that way of life for sure, and the traditions that they pass on and such. So I find that very unique. But if you don't know how to talk to the different type of people, you certainly, you know, are probably failing in your investigations some way, somehow. Very, very cool case. Jeez, you've had a great career. I told you should write a book.
I want to put in one more thing about just the transition over from Alaska State Troopers Wildlife Service. Very similar type of work. Right now, there's Alaska State Troopers are recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a $20,000 bonus.
A $20,000 sign-on bonus?
Sign-on bonus. You get a $10,000 after you complete the academy and $10,000 after you finish your probation.
Yeah.
They are recruiting.
What's your what's the requirements?
You don't even have to have a college degree. You got to apply. It is kind of onus. The application process is I thought it was crazy. You know, everything I had to come up with high school transcripts and college transcripts.
But,
and
but all if, the classes if you're at that been, age, that's a great thing.
Yeah. There's a lot of things. It was hard for me to find that somebody new coming in.
It'll be a lot easier.
A lot easier. But yeah. And then some of the training that takes place at the academy. One thing that's kind of unique to Alaska at their academy, we have what's called Survivor Island. Mm-hmm. It's the last week of our academy where we learn survival skills, and then they take you out on an island, have you jump off a boat, swim to shore, and then you have to survive on the island with what you got for a couple days. You learn, you know, my group, the guys, there were two other guys that were with me. They were both lateral officers. One was a conservation officer out of Michigan. We ended up making a gill net out of parachute cord where we stripped the parachute cord out to the single strands, and then we made a gill net out of it and then put that out in the ocean to catch fish and you learn about survival. And it's just mostly mindset on survival. Mm-hmm. We are surviving there, but it's mostly just to teach you a mindset about survival, because Alaska is different than anywhere else in the United States. And I've For worked sure. all over the United States. It is different. You could find yourself thousand miles from anybody at any time, you know, when you're out on patrol. I mean, a trooper could get sent out some remote village, an airplane has problems, or you could be out on snowmobile patrol, or you could be whatever. And you just have to have that mindset of survival. So they try and instill this Survivor Island. Everybody has to go through and just learn some of those skills that you can survive out in the middle of nowhere with what you got and adapt to what you have. And
yeah. I mean, because the possibilities of that happening in Alaska are much more real than happening probably in the lower 48, for sure. I mean, our snowmobiles could break down, and we could be overnight too.
Yeah.
But again, you prepare for that, and we had radio communication 99% of the time. But you guys are flying in airplanes a lot. You're on snowmobiles a lot. You're in those villages that are 1,000 miles away.
Yep, out in the ocean in these remote areas in the boats.
Yeah. So Survivor Island sounds real to your state, and I think that is so smart to do.
And it's a tradition the Alaska State Troopers have at their academy. Is Survivor Island is that's your kind of your going away party, and you made it. And to me, it was a camping trip. It was fun, but to some, it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, jumping in the water and swimming in. I mean, you start off wet.
Yeah, wet and cold and. Yeah. Having to find and where the academy is in Sitka, it rains quite a bit there. And it doesn't, and usually, luckily, you know, when I did it, it was summertime, and it was beautiful days, so it was really quite nice. But other times, the weather isn't so nice.
Right, for sure. You got lucky. So I'm sure there's been some academies that have had a miserable time of it.
Yeah, especially the ones that graduate in like November.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're freezing rain and pouring rain or whatever winds. And yeah.
And they're still jumping off the boat and swimming into shore and starting from scratch, because that's the way it is.
Yeah. So yeah, that's really unique about the Alaska State Troopers Academy there. And the way the Alaska State Troopers, we're all troopers. Mm-hmm. The blue shirts and brown shirts is what, you know, what some of the public calls us. The brown shirts are the wildlife guys, and the blue shirts are do everything else. Mm-hmm. We all get trained as blue shirts because we never know. We may be the only law enforcement in the village.
Right.
The only one that can handle it. So we all have to learn, you know, everything.
And you all do Survivor Island.
We all do Survivor Island. Yeah. Some of us like it more than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am always fascinated with these shows like Alone, things like that, because I always like to play that game in my head. What would I do? Take pointers from them. And that's the first one. It seemed like real. And I actually did a interview with one of the Alone people. Yeah. And it was it's real. It's real for them. I mean, they are really there by themselves doing their own video. They teach them how to do it. They're surviving on their own. And some of those guys get right into it. And a lot of them don't last the amount they thought they would.
And the biggest tool is the one on top in your head there, your brain. That's your biggest survival tool, because you can adapt to a lot of different things. You can use a lot of different things for survival if you just use your brain.
Right.
That's keeping that mindset of survival.
Mm-hmm.
Survival.
Yep. And then, you know, there's those rules of three, you know, what is it? 3 days without water, three weeks without food, all those things, and what you can do in the process and what you have for material to gather, and your knowledge too. You're right. Your head is the most important tool there. Don't panic and, yeah, get comfortable with it.
Well, Wayne, I really enjoyed talking to you. It's easy to talk to. And,
it's very good.
It just keeps
good. Bringing
back different stories when you talk about.
Yeah, so we should do a third show, right, Chris? No, time goes by very fast. We've been on an hour and 2 minutes here. And it's very easy, like you said, to tell stories. I'm fascinated by Alaska, always have been. I think a lot of us in the 48 are. I'm jealous of your career. I don't say that a whole lot. I've said that about Hawaii, now Alaska. you just can't do it all in one lifetime.
I've been lucky. Yeah. It's a playground for a game warden, for sure.
Oh, it sounds epic.
And especially here on the Kenai, because I actually, you know, I live in a nice house and road system, but it doesn't take long to get out in the wilderness and all the resources that are
right
so
there.
Close by. And then with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I got to travel all over the country doing things.
Right.
I got to go down to Puerto Rico and do stuff, Arizona, Texas border. That was kind of fun. That was interesting to do. I wouldn't want to do it full time, but it was kind of like playing hide and seek for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
Working down the borders and being on the CERT team here in Alaska, I got to do a lot of different interesting calls. And yeah, it's been a good career. And I just enjoy what I do.
I get it. And thank you for your service on both sides, to the federal side of it and now to the state side of it. You know, it's funny, one of my students said he was going to go to Alaska and be an Alaskan state trooper, and he graduates here in May, so that'll be interesting if he follows through.
If he has any questions, you can direct them to me. Just have him call or text me, email,
sure.
Whatever.
For sure. Well, thanks again, Chris. I appreciate sharing your experiences with the Warden's Watch listeners. Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.